morning, and welcome back to our study of Acts. Come on in and have a seat. There are several handouts there on the table that you'll want to grab if you don't have them already. And find a seat, and we'll get started. We had come almost to the end of chapter 11 last time. I didn't recopy the sheet for chapter 11 because we only have one question left on it. But we're going to be starting at Acts 11, verse 27. And let's begin with prayer. Lord Jesus, show us the boldness that the apostles and the early Christians had. They had no fear because they knew that you were always with them. You had given them the commission to witness, and so they went out unafraid, bold in their proclamation that you are the only Savior from sin and death. Give us that same boldness, that we may go forth and unafraid tell others your message of salvation. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, as I mentioned, we are near the end of Acts chapter 11. We are beginning to see how the apostles are moving farther and farther outside of the realm of Israel to proclaim the gospel. Last time we got as far as Antioch. I hope you can see this map. Okay, there's really two of them. One of them is how it looks, or looked back in the days of the apostles with some of the borders and stuff. And today, the borders today are on the bottom sketch. It's really the same view. And we had seen that the focus now is on Antioch, a city right here, quite far, several hundred miles north of Israel, just about where there's that bend in the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And we had seen how Barnabas there was preaching to Gentiles, pure-blooded Gentiles now. It's getting beyond the Jewish people. And we saw him go over and get Saul, who the last time we saw him had returned to his hometown of Tarsus, which was just around the corner there, up in what is today Turkey. And now Saul is beginning to preach, as God had called him to be the missionary to the Gentiles. So now he is going to start to come into focus. And we left off at verse 27, let me read it. During this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. The disciples, each according to his ability, decided to provide help for the brothers living in Judea. This they did, sending their gift to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. For the first time here in Acts, we hear about prophets mentioned. We usually think of prophets as being Old Testament messengers of God, right? But notice that in the early Christian church, there were also prophets. A prophet, of course, is what? What does a prophet do? Speaks God's word, right. Good. I'm glad you gave me that one first, because the other thing they often proclaim is usually the thing people think of first. But it's best for us to think of them as purely proclaimers of God's word. Many different types of messages. The word from the Greek language is very descriptive of their duties. It comes from pro, which means for, and phate, which means speak. They speak for God. Any message that God once revealed, he can speak through a prophet. But of course, the word prophet has come over into our English language to focus really on what specific type of message that the prophets are most famous for in general, I would say. Carl?
Predicting the future.
And in this case, too, we see that this particular prophet predicts the future, right? His name is Agabus, and he predicts that there's going to be a famine. How wide-ranging is it? A severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. In the days of Claudius, in my homework this week, I discovered Claudius reigned from, I think it was 41 to 54 AD. So that kind of helps us to date. Remember, we're quite a while after the Pentecost event by this time. We figured last time we were probably about 12 or more years after the time of Pentecost here. So sometime in the 40s AD. And the question in connection with this one that I asked is, why do you think Luke includes the prediction of the famine in his account? He doesn't tell us much about it, but he just mentions it. And then the next question is, why do the believers in Antioch send gifts to the believers in Jerusalem rather than vice versa? When I read it, I thought, well, wouldn't the church be better established in Jerusalem? And wouldn't we expect them to help out the mission congregation up there in Antioch? What did you find in your study and in your thinking about the question? Steve? Okay. Good point. I hadn't even thought of that. Antioch would be more in a position to receive goods from far distances. Steve says, like, maybe even from Russia, from the Black Sea and that sort of thing, and other places in the Mediterranean, because it's located near the water, right? Another thing that occurred to me as Steve was talking is, I think I've read several times when studying for this class, that Antioch was the third largest city in the world at this time, after Rome and Alexandria in Egypt. So Antioch would be a place where there are more resources. Jerusalem is a more provincial capital that isn't as involved in trade, isn't as linked in the Roman trading system. Good point. Anyone else find another reason? Craig?
Well, when I gathered some of the information, I believe that the gift was an expression of their love for the Lord and then their fellowship with Jewish believers.
Okay. It was a gift for the Lord, really, Craig says, and also an expression of their fellowship with Jewish believers. I think it would be viewed as a nice thank you, right, for sending the messengers to them to tell them the gospel. This would be a way that they could respond and say thank you to the home church. Okay, Steve?
I think Jerusalem was the center of heavy persecution, too, so if you were a Christian, you getting a job or owning property would be confiscated, that type of thing. So they would be, where Antioch was more in the fringes, in the center of the persecution. So I think Christians had a tougher time in Jerusalem. It's like in Russia, if you're a Christian, you don't get a job.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah, the persecution that was going on in Jerusalem, Steve says, probably played into it too. That maybe they couldn't get work. Or remember too how they had, a lot of them had sold their property and given it to the church. I wonder if that impacted the situation. What struck me as I considered the question was how often now for the rest of the New Testament there's going to be talk about gathering offerings for the Christians in Jerusalem. I just wonder if they were maybe even the poorer classes of society. And so they were continually in need, and the other congregations that would get started throughout the world got in the habit of always sending money back to the church at Jerusalem. As I was thinking, the persecution idea played into my mind too, that there they would be in the spotlight or the hotbed of the Jewish Christian controversy. And so all these factors probably played into the fact that they would send offerings to Jerusalem rather than vice versa. Jerusalem, too, is built on a kind of a ridge of hills, and I would think that there isn't much agriculture around there at this time, and that they relied on other areas to send them food. So then if a famine comes into the land, you'd be particularly vulnerable in that type of situation. Anyone else come across any other reasons? Dave?
I was back to the first question about prophecy.
Oh, okay.
Especially since Luke comments right afterwards that it really happened, it seems to me that he's wanting to validate the office of prophecy.
Okay, excellent point too. Luke probably brings it up because Agabus prophesied this and it happens, right? So he wants to authenticate the message of these preachers, right? That their message really was from God. Going back to that question, anybody see another reason why Luke might mention it? It's a famine throughout the Roman world. It happened during the reign of Claudius. Does that sound like Luke's usual? Why would Luke bring that up? Brett?
To date it, to establish it more times.
True. He's done that numerous times, especially in his gospel, where he wants to date it for people so that they understand this is a history. This isn't just, you know, a bunch of made-up stuff or just vague recollections of these old apostles in their last days or something like that. But he's trying to be very historical. Give me another reason why Luke, in particular, would have included this. Steve?
I think part of it, too, is that he's showing the explosion of the gospel almost in reverse, too. We're going out from Jerusalem to the gospel, and we're bringing back things in.
Oh. Yeah, a network of these Christians is being set up by this time, right? Not only have they established outposts in the Gentile world, but the ties between the Jewish world and the Gentile world have been formed and are being fostered. The one that occurred to me with Luke is, remember that Luke's, one of his main themes in both books is how the gospel is for the Gentiles. And if this is a famine that reaches the whole Roman world, Claudius is a Gentile, right? He wants to show how this Christian faith is impacting the Gentile world. Here comes this famine, and these Christians step up to the plate and answer the needs of the people who are suffering with it, right? So I think it fits into his emphasis about how the gospel is for all nations. Anyone else on the famine? Gwen? Yeah. Good point. Good point. Gwen is wondering, and I don't know if I have the answer for it, was it common to help outside of your community in those days? Or did you kind of, you know, Jews help Jews, Macedonians help Macedonians, Greeks help Greek? And is this maybe a sign of how the Christian faith, with its universal message, is really getting through to people because now they want to help one another? Jew wants to help Gentiles. I would think so. Yeah, I don't know how much of this was going on before, but it clearly is part of the Christian message, right? That's active here. It's being shown not just in the words, but in the deeds of the people, right? Good point. Anyone else on the famine? Okay, then let's move forward. Here's the sign-up sheet. Please circle the number next to your name or add yourself if you're new today. And we go on to chapter 12, Peter's miraculous escape from prison. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. When he saw that this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After arresting him, he put him in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. Let me pause there for a little while and let's discuss the questions on part 12. The first one is, using Bible helps, find out which King Herod appears in this chapter. What did you discover? The Herods were really a whole dynasty of rulers in this part of the world, right? In the New Testament period. And it's often confusing to us because one will die off and all of a sudden there's another King Herod. Well, and maybe when you're reading along, you think, well, didn't he die? Explain to me the interconnection here. Which Herod is this? Dave?
It appears that he was the grandson of Herod the Great. He was one of the most children that I've come to pray for.
Right.
And his father was Aristobulus, or something like that.
Aristobulus.
And also the minister of Herod's Antipas, who beheaded John the Baptist.
Good. Very good. You did your homework. This one is Herod Agrippa, who was the grandson of Herod the Great, the one who murdered all the boys in Bethlehem, and the nephew of Herod Antipas, who was the one who beheaded John the Baptist. Dave even found the name of this guy's father, who must have been a brother of the one I just mentioned, Aristobulus, and that's how he comes to the throne here now. So it's Herod Agrippa. Next one. Luke seems so matter of fact when reporting the death of James in verse 2. This was the James of Peter, James, and John fame, one of Jesus' closest disciples. Why do you think Luke relegates James and John to such footnotes in the book of Acts while focusing so much on the events of Peter's and Paul's ministries? This has always struck me when I get to this chapter. Oh, and by the way, James was put to death with the sword. You know, he spent so much time on Stephen, you know, who wasn't even one of the 12. Why so little discussion about James? Steve?
I think primarily his focus is not on what is happening in the persecutions, but on the gospel spreading.
Yes.
This is a horrible thing. Stephen was important, if you want to contrast it, is that he was a Greek Jew helping that, and it was a different thing. This was a disciple, and he knew some of the disciples and the apostles and so on were going to die.
Yeah.
They said that they were going to suffer for him. So it's just a matter of fact, because it is a factor that he's looking for in the spread of the gospel, which is his focus on the story.
He focuses on the spread of the gospel rather than on the persecution that's going on. Steve even mentioned the stoning of Stephen. Why would Luke have interest in Stephen being stoned, since Stephen was a Grecian Jew? Again, he's focused on the Gentiles, right, rather than the Jews. And maybe he's, with Stephen's death too, you know, he tells about the beginning of the persecution and he makes quite a bit of it, but then, you know, it's like a minor theme for him. So now he's going to be moving on more toward how the gospel spread rather than reporting how each of the apostles were killed or that sort of thing. Somebody else had a hand. I think it was Joyce first. Very good question. Where was Luke? Now we're starting to have him in focus. Well, how does he get in on the whole thing? You know, where is he from? We always have this difficulty with the New Testament writers because they were very modest people who did not want to include themselves in the account. And I think I mentioned the first day when we got together, Luke pops up in this message, in this book, only when the word we starts to pop up. It's coming up in one of the chapters right ahead of us where he will say, Paul and Barnabas went to such and such, and then they did this, and then they went here, and then they did that. And then at a certain point in time, and we went to, and all of a sudden he's along on the journey, but he won't even mention himself. So there's been a lot of speculation. I think one of the main places that people have suggested that he may have come from was Antioch. So this is about the time probably that he was converted and begins to be active in the Christian church. And so what Joyce's question is leading us to, well, James is down there in Jerusalem, right? And so Luke, just personally, maybe never met James, didn't really have a reason to bring him up. Another thing that intrigued me as I considered that question was, I think it's interesting how he drops John like a hot potato, or not, drops John like a, I don't even know what my metaphor was, but he just kind of drops John at the point that he does, because he's accomplished his purpose with John. Do you remember the last time John was mentioned? We had it back in chapter 8. When they go up to Samaria, remember the Samaritans believe, and then they ask for some apostles to come and authenticate things. And Peter and John go to Samaria, and that's when they lay the hands on the people, and the people get the miraculous abilities from the Holy Spirit. And to my knowledge, that's the last time John is mentioned. And I'm wondering if that's the last time, because Luke's achieved his purpose with John. He brought up John numerous times in the gospel, and one of the key times was when John and James wanted to bring fire down from heaven on the Samaritan village. And Jesus rebuked them. They were just so far off track at the time. And now John has come around to see, oh, even the Samaritans can believe. And Luke has achieved his purpose with John. So he doesn't mention John again. I wonder if it's the same with James. If these guys don't play into the spread of the gospel to the Gentiles, then Luke doesn't see much purpose in continuing their saga in his book. One thing I should point out maybe at this time is that people have always been intrigued that this book is called Acts of the Apostles when not many of the apostles are mentioned in it, as far as what their ministry was, where they went. He concentrates almost exclusively on Peter and Paul in the book, right? And Peter really only when Peter has something to do with the Gentiles, right? We're going to see Peter dropping away from the scene too, starting next chapter. We had that whole scene. He spent two chapters on the vision from heaven about how all the meat was clean to eat now and how Peter could enter the Gentiles' home. And he seems to have accomplished his purpose with Peter. So now he's going to move on to Paul. Because Luke, remember, is a Gentile himself. And he wants to show in this book the transition from Judaism to Christianity. That may be the reason he drops James. I'm not sure. Trish?
Well, I had two thoughts. One, that this really is the book about Peter and Paul, and it's really those that are famous. He may just throw some of his names in there as, again, a way to date the time of the book. And the second thing is that when it starts the transition into later on, when he starts saying the we and the us, including himself, he's mainly with Paul, and I'm wondering if
good point, too. Luke was the companion of the Apostle Paul, so obviously he got most of his information from Paul, and he wants to record this stuff that he has a personal interest in, right? Paul was there at the stoning of Stephen, interestingly enough, you know, because he wasn't a Christian yet. It would be years before he would be converted. Well, not maybe years, but a time before he would be converted. And so Luke is focusing in on Paul's story. There's no question about it. Yes, Mr. Walker.
The other thing I was thinking about was that when we considered who wrote the epistles, it was primarily Paul.
Yeah.
And then Peter wrote three.
Two. Good point. Luke mentions the authors of the epistles and gives prominence to the one that we have the most epistles of. Just one caution with that, James does not seem to have been written by the disciple James, but by James, the brother of Jesus. And so that might have contributed, though, to him not mentioning this James much in Acts either. Yeah. Let me give you that encouragement again I did earlier on. Start to see how all the epistles of Paul go together with the book of Acts. I think that's part of the reason that Luke writes it, so that we can kind of weave together the whole, when was Galatians written and what was the purpose in it? When was 1 Corinthians written and how did it play into the gospel explosion, right? Because that's a very intricate mix that is one of our best reasons, we Bible-believing Christians, one of our best reasons for not going with these theories that say these books were all written later by people who kind of faked, you know, added Paul's name to them or whatever. Acts and the epistles just link together beautifully, and there's several different authors would have had to get together and really concocted a plot in order for everything to come together the way it has. If you follow any other theory other than that, Paul wrote those 13 epistles that are attributed to him, and Luke wrote Acts, and, you know, it fits together beautifully, the New Testament. It really does. And so that's part of Luke's plan in writing, probably, as to why he follows the apostles that he does. Okay, enough on that one. Then let's go on to the third one on that sheet. What would have been particularly ominous for the Christian community in the fact that Peter was arrested during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, according to verse 3? Joyce? Yeah. Because of Jesus' death during the Passover, right? These Christians were probably thinking to themselves, oh no, now Peter's going to go to, he's got Peter in prison. And it's particularly ominous too in that Herod has just killed James. So they had to be thinking, Peter's the next one to go, right? And the fourth one, look closely at the details of Luke's account of Peter's imprisonment and miraculous release, according to verses 4 through 10. How do these details highlight the seriousness with which Herod viewed the apostles' preaching and the power that God has over those who oppose him? Let me read those verses for you. I'll go back up to verse 4. After arresting him, Herod put Peter in prison, handing him over to be guarded by four squads of four soldiers each. Herod intended to bring him out for public trial after the Passover. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. The night before Herod was to bring him to trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Suddenly an angel of the Lord appeared, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him up. "Quick, get up," he said, and the chains fell off Peter's wrists. Then the angel said to him, "Put on your clothes and sandals." And Peter did so. "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me," the angel told him. Peter followed him out of the prison. But he had no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was seeing a vision. They passed the first and second guards and came to the iron gate leading to the city. It opened for them by itself, and they went through it. When they had walked the length of one street, suddenly the angel left him. What details do you see in there about the seriousness with which Herod is taking this arrest of Peter? Dave?
It's pretty obvious. I'm nervous about this whole thing because the way he had Peter change up 16 guards, changing ships like that, he was not taking any chance.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever heard of somebody in prison where there were two guards, one on each side of you as you were sleeping. You know, what might Herod have been thinking of that has happened in the past that he wanted to avoid this time? Bill?
When Jesus' resurrection, I mean, he had guards posted.
Yeah.
And there's no body.
Yeah.
He doesn't want a repeat of that.
Pilate had posted guards at Jesus' tomb, and they fainted and became like dead men, and Jesus rose. And he didn't want that happening again, because when that body disappeared, that was just all the food for these people's nonsense, he would call it, of preaching, you know, Jesus is risen from the dead, and he didn't want something like that happening. Can you think of one that's happened in Acts 2 already that was similar to this? Steve? Something very similar happened already in Acts, right? When they were arrested for preaching and the gates to the jail came open and Peter was out, remember? And by the time the Sanhedrin got around to getting him out of the prison the next day, they were already in the temple courts preaching again. Remember we said it was almost kind of comical? Because the soldiers went to the jail and looked for them and there's nobody in the jail? Yeah, they didn't want that happening again. Dave?
It would be interesting to see what Herod's
expression was. Yeah, that he's gone again after I chained to, I forget, it must have been in the People's Bible, huh? That mentioned, I don't know where the professor who wrote that got the fact, but that if they would do something like this, they would actually chain the prisoner to the soldiers, and that both chains would have been put through all three men's shackles or whatever, so that they were chained to one another to make sure that this didn't happen. And it happened anyway. Yeah. Anything else about the seriousness with which Herod was taking this? Then let's look at the opposite. How is Luke trying to illustrate the power of God in the whole scene? Bill?
Besides the guards that were sleeping on either or chained with him, he had to pass two sets of sentries, mm-hmm. which were on 24-hour guard, literally,
yeah.
and walk out through the prison, through the locked gates,
yeah.
and out into the street, and he was never noticed.
Yeah, they get to the iron gate, and it opens all by itself, right? Not only guards, which must have been incapacitated in some way, but the chains, the gate is opened all by itself so that there would be no explanation for how did this guy get out of here. Huh? The power of God. Another thing that struck me too as I was studying it this week, I like how the NIV has set aside verse 5 in its own little paragraph. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. Notice the prayers were going on as this happens, right? Steve?
Also, it shows that Peter wasn't acting on his own. He thought he was in a vision.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's sleepwalking out of the place as opposed to actively looking for guards or anything like that.
It's nothing Peter's doing, right? From the very beginning, the angel has to strike him to wake him up. Professor Balgi mentioned in the People's Bible, I found that really intriguing too. Peter could sleep well. It must have been a sign of fearlessness, you know, of God has everything under control. Here I am in prison. but he's just sleeping soundly that the angel has to wake him up, and he seems to be almost walking in a sleep when he comes to, right? Thinking it's a dream. That's how peacefully he's sleeping. Right?
I'm reminded of times when I'm in a situation and I don't see any way out of it, and it just is, you get to the point where all you have left is prayer, and yet you think, well, how is God going to come and answer this? Well, he could do this, or he could do that. And it's never the way I think it could happen.
Yeah.
He always finds another way. And it's clear that I shouldn't be wasting my time doing that.
Yeah.
I should be resting.
Why do we box God into corners of our mind, right? That he could never get me out of this. Complete foolishness. He always provides a way to escape. What is that scripture that says that?
1 Corinthians 10:13.
That's right, yeah. 1 Corinthians 10:13, right? How does it start again? No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you are tempted, he will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it, or something to that effect, right? Yeah. Why do we doubt God? He can do it. Just put your trust in him. Pray to him, as Brett is saying. Be in his word. We're going to have several of these scenes where apostles are going to be freed from prison. And prayer is one thing that is mentioned. Do you remember in the next one when Paul is put in prison and then escapes, what he and his companions were doing? Singing hymns, right? These are the kind of things that Christians should do when they're at those spots, where they're in those tight spots, right? And the Lord will release us. I think these are written for our benefit, aren't they? They're not just there to tell us the history of what happened in the lives of God's people. It's there to say, God can do it in my life too. That's making me think again. Notice how Luke is so much setting the stage of having parallel accounts between Peter and Paul. Here, Peter is released from prison by an angel. And remember, Paul in Philippi is released from prison, not through an angel, but anybody remember God's instrument that time? Through an earthquake, right? And then the doors of the prison come open. So he's setting these stages for these parallel accounts so that we can see he did it with Peter, he did it with Paul. And almost an unspoken message that then goes on is, and he can do it for you, right? Steve? Steve brings up a good point. Let's see, what was your first one again? He's wondering if the revolt against the Romans is already beginning now. Remember that this is just the 40s, and that revolt ended in 70 AD, so it's quite a while before it. But there was always unrest, right, with the Jews. And it's clear that Herod is trying to court their favor to make them happy, because it says when they saw that he killed James, and saw that it pleased the Jews, then he put Peter in prison. So he's definitely doing that, right? I wanted to show you on this, I don't think I've ever shown you this one before. This is the city of Jerusalem today, and you can see the outlines of the temple courts. There are no buildings standing on it, or very few buildings standing on it now. The Dome of the Rock, you can see in the center there, is where the actual temple building was. But you can see that the grounds around it were quite extensive and still are today. And I wanted to show you this because the commentaries that we used said he was probably in the Antonia Fortress, which is over here, named after that family that Mark Antony belonged to, the Antonia Fortress. And that was controlled by the Romans. Herod seems to have been, this Herod Agrippa seems to be the one that is in control now in place of Pilate in this area. So he probably used that fortress there in that corner of the temple grounds as the place that Peter was in prison. I point this out because it was a different prison, evidently, than the previous time. The previous time, the temple soldiers had imprisoned them. Those would have been Jewish soldiers that were just in charge of keeping peace here in the temple courts. But now this is a more serious imprisonment where he's in a fortress that's controlled by Roman soldiers. That's why I wanted to show you that one. Gwen? Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought of it quite from that angle before. These miraculous signs had often happened among the Jews, but now the miraculous signs seem to accompany the Christians rather than the Jews. And wouldn't the Jews have noticed this? Why? I don't know. I'm baffled by it too, I would say. Because that's the purpose of the signs, right? From everything we've studied in Acts so far, to confirm the gospel message. Shouldn't they have seen just from the signs that this is the direction God was going in? Okay, can we go on to the next one? The next question says, using Bible helps, find out how as much as you can about Mary and John Mark in verse 12. How was their home being used at this time? What does this teach us about how Christians viewed their homes in the early church? Let me read those verses for you. I finished off at 10. 11 says, "Then Peter came to himself and said, 'Now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating. When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying.'" See, evidently they were praying at the very time he came out of the prison, right? What did you find out about this Mary and John, who is also called Mark? It's so confusing because they seem to have only used a few names in their culture, which isn't uncommon. We're starting to do this mission work among the Hmong people in the Central Valley. And what do they say? It's something like only 12 or 18 last names that they have. They're so interrelated. Which Mary was this, and which John was this? What did you find? Wayne?
The guy said, John Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark. His mother's house was large enough to accommodate a meeting of many believers. An upstairs room in this house may have been a location for Jesus' Last Supper with his disciples.
Okay, good. This is the John who also had the name Mark and is, as best as we can tell, the man who wrote the gospel according to St. Mark. I'm guessing that he was originally Jewish. That's why he has a Jewish name. John is a Jewish name. Means Jehovah is gracious. And Mark is a more Roman name, like Mark Antony. So he seems to have gotten this name maybe even later in life. I don't know what his connections would be with the Roman people. But they lived in a house that had an upper room, and so people sometimes wonder if it could be the upper room that Jesus ate his last supper in. Any other details that you found out about Mary and Mark? Yes? I don't think it was sister of Barnabas.
Yeah.
An aunt of Barnabas, right. Because in Colossians chapter 4, it says that Mark and Barnabas were cousins. Okay? So, notice that a lot of these early Christians were related to one another. Of course, what could we learn for that about our own witness? Witness to family members, right? I was just talking with a lady this week who's going to be joining St. Mark's, just finished up Bible information class, and she said she had been very active in a previous church where they did outreach, went door to door, and she said it was very ineffective. Their church found the most effective way was through family members, friends. You already have a connection with those people. They trust you. And so if you invite them to your church, they're more likely to come than a total stranger who you invite. Mm-hmm. Anything else on Mary and Mark? Steve?
The other thing I was thinking that Barnabas, if you take an honor, will probably from Antioch as well. Maybe you talked to Mark, probably got the wrong name. Mm-hmm. Antioch was basically the Phoenician town, which was, you know, the sailing people over the merchants. Probably had to have your Roman presence in the city. Mm-hmm. So Mark, you know, John Mark could have been, you know, like Saul Peter, you know, like Saul and Paul. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we changed some of the names in there with it. Mm-hmm.
Steve wonders if they came from Antioch too, and perhaps that being a more cosmopolitan city is where Mark would have connections with Romans.
Sue.
Sue?
John Mark also worked with the Paul and Barnabas, the first missionary journey for part of it.
Right. He's going to go on the first missionary journey with Paul and Barnabas. Oh, I know another thing I wanted to piggyback on Steve's comment. Where did Barnabas come from? That might give us an indication of where they came from. It's close to Antioch. Anybody remember? To island of Cyprus, which is just off the mainland from Antioch. So maybe they did come from the north there in the more Gentile regions for some reason. Keep in mind too that Mark, many people believe, was the young man who fled when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, which would mean that he had an earlier connection with Jesus. He didn't just learn about Jesus from the apostles, because Mark is the only one that mentions that, and it just seems like such a superfluous little additional comment that this young man tried to run away when Jesus was arrested and they grabbed his cloak and he fled naked. Why even mention that if you're not personally connected with the incident or the person itself? So many people have wondered if that's John Mark there. And then it would lead us to say, well, then he must have come to Jerusalem before Barnabas did. And that may work a little bit against Steve's theory. Okay, I think that's all we can glean about those two. What about the thing with how Christians viewed their homes in the early Christian church? Did you find anything on that? The early Christian churches always seem to have met in homes. This seems to be one of the first indications of it, that that's where the believers gathered. We know that later on when the persecution became more intense, that they'd have to hide out in places like homes. They couldn't go into public buildings because that made it more likely that they would be arrested. So the first 300 years of the Christian church, the norm was to have worship services in homes. We've heard of the hospitality. We've seen it in several of the chapters of Acts so far. And it would lead us to believe that these people had a more open, hospitable, inviting type of situation than we, who kind of want to cocoon in our homes and get away from the world rather than invite large numbers of people in. Right? And our next question is, the congregation's comments about Peter's angel in verse 15 seems to indicate a belief that each of us believers has a personal angel. Using Bible helps find out as much as the Bible teaches about this. And how does this teaching help to encourage you to play an active part in the gospel explosion? What did you find out about this? What does the Bible actually teach about guardian angels, they're usually called? Is that a true biblical teaching? If so, where do you find it? What did you find out about each of us having a personal angel? Bill?
In Matthew 18:10, there's a reference there about when Jesus is talking about the little children, that each of them has an angel who is always in the face of God.
Yes. That's probably the clearest one that there is in the Bible. Matthew 18:10, the angels of the little ones always see the face of their Father in heaven. Anybody else come up with another one? Clara? I copied that one down to Psalm 34:7, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Anybody find another one? Dave?
Hebrews 1:14, are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation?
Good. Hebrews 1:14, all angels are ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation. Anybody find any others? All those, I've got one more. Psalm 91:11 says, we're going to sing it today. It's our psalm for worship today. He will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. I would think that's probably the one where we got the guardian part of guardian angel, right? But they are all passages that seem to hint at it, but there's no particular place that kind of fleshes out, okay, this is what the guardian angels do. What intriguing thing did you notice in this particular passage here in Acts 12 about what some unique things about these guardian angels, if they do so exist? What was the belief in the early Christian church about them?
That they looked like the person they were guarding.
That they look like you. And sometimes they would appear in your, you know, the way you look. Because they say there's no way. Notice, even these who are praying so fervently are like Brett. You know, kind of box themselves in. God couldn't possibly get Peter out of this. So it must be his angel that's there by the door. Even they're trying to come up with alternative explanations, right? And they're kind of grasping at straws is what I'm pointing at, right? Certainly all four of these passages that we brought up here are good ones for our comfort. But notice God hasn't revealed this very clearly to us. So we don't know if they look like us, if they can appear. Gwen. I think that's what it would be implying, right? Gwen wonders if Hebrews 1:14 is implying that believers have angels, guardian angels, but that unbelievers don't.
Hebrews 13:2 also says, do not forget to entertain strangers for doing so. Some people have entertained angels without knowing. Then 3 is to remember those in prison as if you were their fellow prisoners, and those who are on the street as if put themselves in
Okay, Steve brings up a good point. We don't want to just limit all angels to being guardian angels, right? Angels can come. Hebrews 13 says that sometimes people have served angels who have appeared and come to their house so that there would be the possibility of they could appear to us. And it is linked next to a passage that talks about visiting those in prison and that sort of thing. Jay? Jenny mentions the bright light that appeared when the resurrection angel appeared, you know, so that wouldn't lead you to recognize them as a person, right? But she wonders about the wings, the feathers, all those kind of things. Actually, I think the way the Bible portrays them, they look quite different than they do on television. Remember the ones I think the clearest one in the Bible is the Isaiah 6 one that says they have six wings, with two they cover their faces, with two they cover their feet, and with two they fly around. Don't just, you know, gather this Hollywood version of what an angel is, but look at what the Bible has to say about them. They definitely do have wings. I don't know if this, it's something, though, that we can go into, just because of a casual reference like this, that we can go into to a study of angels. I think it would be good for us maybe to continue on the top of the next page. How about 17? Who is the James Peter refers to in verse 17? Because when he appears there, it says, he says to them, when Rhoda finally lets him in, remember, she just goes running back, oh, it sounds like Peter. Peter's at the gate. And that's when they say, well, it must be his angel. And then finally they go and let him in. And then he says in 17, Peter motioned with his hand for them to be quiet and described how the Lord had brought him out of prison. Tell James and the brothers about this, he said. And then he left for another place. I thought James was just put to death. Why would he say, go tell James? Steve?
James, the brother of Jesus. He's a leader in Jerusalem.
Exactly. This is the first time that James, the brother of Jesus, is going to appear in Acts. He's going to be a very prominent figure in Acts 15, so keep an eye out for him. It was not the disciple James. There were actually two disciples by the name of James, and it wasn't either of them. This was Jesus' brother James. Okay, our time is just about up, so in case I get cut off, let me point out to you, there is an extra sheet. Oh, they've all been swallowed up, though. I made them available on Ash Wednesday already. For your homework for next week, as you finish up chapter 12, you're going to want to read that. It's a very intriguing section from the works of Josephus, where he describes the death of this Herod Agrippa in a very similar way to the way that Luke describes it. But there are some additional details that will be very intriguing for you. What I want you to do for your homework for next time is compare what Josephus has to say about the death of Herod to what Luke's account says about it. And that's where we'll get started next time. Notice also that chapter 13, or part 13, is available for you. Start working on that. I do have one request with that one. When I worked on it last night, I thought to myself, I would really like to have a map, a blank map, of the areas of the world where Paul went on his missionary journeys, where each of us could trace the journey for ourselves. I think often we look on Bible maps that have the route traced, and if we do it ourselves, it'll get impressed on our mind more. So if anybody in the next week comes across, I could not find one among all of my maps, one that's just, you know, a map. It would especially be good if it were just white with lines outlining Turkey and everything, maybe listing the cities, but has no route marks on it that each of us can mark our own routes out. I would like to share that with the class. So if anybody is aware of one, please let me know sometime during this week. Okay? And we will see you next Sunday. I wonder. I have that one too, and I didn't think of it.
You know, it's only got.
Let me try expanding it and see if, you know.
Because it was, you gave it right at the beginning.
Right.
That one, and I don't think it has lines on it.
Here's the attendance sheet.
Thank you.
Did you find that your mic was a little too loud? Do I need to adjust that for second service, or is it fine with you?
I didn't think so,
okay.
But it's always what other people think more than...
Okay. Okay, I just wanted to ask.
I didn't think so.
I gotta set my stereo.
I gotta shut this off. Excuse me.